Chapter 9. Turn the dial so you don't spiral.
It's your fault.
No, you didn't tell me.
Yes, I did.
Why can't you do anything right?
Relationships and arguing come hand in hand. Even the most easygoing and stable among us find ourselves in heated debates with our loved ones. Sometimes it's over something important, financial troubles or your future plans. But often it's about something with far less meaning. Someone forgets to take the trash out or pick up the flower at the store. Anger and frustration mount. And before you know it, World War III erupts in the living room. A seemingly superfluous trigger causes an avalanche of emotions and feelings that fail to dissipate until nearly everything is destroyed. It's as if we revert back to our early childhood, throwing a tantrum because we didn't get what we wanted or got caught stealing from the cookie jar. And from the outside looking in, the adult version often looks as ludicrous as the tantrum. Ask any teenager who's witnessed their parents blow up over something inconsequential. During such fits, teenagers often roll their eyes while relaying to their siblings, "Mom and Dad are arguing over the dishwasher. Let them chill out. They're in crazy mode." But to the adults arguing, it seems real and of dire importance. It may start small, but as the swirl of thoughts, emotions, and feelings builds, even the inconsequential can grow into a giant snowball hurtling down the mountain. When the avalanche starts, when our brain seems to go offline, we often feel powerless. Like anger has taken over, and we have no option but to wait until it dissipates. When we're at our breaking point, when exhaustion from parenting, work, or just life takes over, the old model of toughness fails. Resisting, pushing through, and playing through the pain are all akin to telling your parents, child, partner, or whoever is in the midst of their tantrum to calm down. It never works, and often feeds the monster. There's a better way to deal with this cascade of events. Whether it's arguing with loved ones, feeling so overwhelmed that you don't feel like you can step foot in the conference room, or becoming so frustrated that you are about to quit, when we're at our breaking point, we still have options. Up until this point, we've covered how to rethink our relationship with toughness, how we can develop the mindset and skills to navigate adversity. This chapter outlines what to do when we're at our breaking point, when the response or reaction is upon us, when burnout, blow up, or freak out is the next seemingly unavoidable step. When the snowball is rolling down that mountain, picking up steam, and barreling toward destruction, what do we do to stop the potential avalanche? Divert it, destroy it, or slow it down? The answer lies in learning how to cope. Coping with fear. Surrounded by a group of friends, Moise Joseph and Tom Abbey stood out. They came from different backgrounds. Mo was Haitian. Tom was from upstate New York. But with one look at them, you could tell they were phenomenal athletes. Mo was an Olympian. Tom had fallen just short in an elite development program to become one. Both had dedicated a large portion of their lives to attaining fitness levels that few of us could imagine. They'd competed in front of large crowds, overcome anxiety, stress, and fear to perform at their best. They were both risk-takers. Mo had moved across the country to pursue his dream to become the best athlete he could be. Tom had done the same in the athletic world before taking the entrepreneurial route and founding his own business. But as they entered the old rickety haunted house in rural Virginia, their mindsets couldn't have been more different. Mo was visibly shaking, a nervous wreck. As the group entered the home, his eyes locked onto the person in front of him, and his towering frame became diminished. The 6-foot-tall Olympian tried to shrink behind the 5-foot-6-inch women who were also on the tour of the haunted house. When zombies popped out of the dark, Mo would dart to the other side of the room, letting out a scream along the way. As he neared the finish and found himself in a pitch-dark room, his impatience grew, and he called out, "Move faster, move faster," to any who would listen. Until finally, the dam broke. He could take no more. At the buzz of a chainsaw, unable to contain his fear any longer, he bolted for the exit, using his world-class speed to fly by any actor who dared step in his way. Tom, on the other hand, was excited. With every disfigured actor or scary clown that jumped out of the shadows, Tom's intensity climbed. He was fully immersed. Like Mo, he let out screams, but they were of a different variety. They didn't come from a place of fright, but of a strange mix of excitement and deliberately developed fear. His eyes were wide open. Tom wasn't trying to survive or get to the exit. He was absorbed in the activity, taking the cliched advice to live in the moment to its logical extreme, letting every ounce of fake blood and each severed body part take him to the next level. Tom was fully immersed in the experience. Tom and Mo both experienced the same emotional state, fear, but how they handled it differed entirely. Tom amplified. Mo tried to cope and turn the volume of the experience down. A group of researchers out of Aarhus University in Denmark discovered that haunted house visitors could be divided into two categories, adrenaline junkies and white knucklers, one amplified, the other suppressed. Upon completing the frightful experience, both groups have remarkably similar levels of satisfaction and enjoyment, but they have markedly different experiences. Adrenaline junkies achieve enjoyment by attempting to maximize their emotional arousal. On the other hand, white knucklers reach nearly the same satisfaction by employing the opposite approach, minimizing arousal. One group upregulated their fear, the other dampened. Using a combination of video footage and interviews as participants made their way through a haunted house, the researchers found that each group utilized an assortment of cognitive and behavioral approaches to achieve their goal of adjusting the emotional volume. But if we peer further into the strategies, a commonality arises. How they directed their attention played a large role. When we are faced with fear or any other form of discomfort, our coping strategy influences our experience and our behavioral approach. We can turn the volume up, diving into the experience, or we can turn the volume down, directing our attention away or reframing it, reminding ourselves that it isn't real. It's not that either strategy is right or wrong. The question is whether it matches the situation and our goals. Sometimes the answer is to be like Tom, amp up the experience, so we feel the thrill of being frightened. Other times, we need to turn the volume down to keep our mind from being overwhelmed. Coping strategies allow us to maintain the right balance during ever-increasing levels of stress, keeping our brain and body in the sweet spot to be able to perform. Sitting atop the top 10 strategies used by adrenaline junkies to amplify their fear was to focus on the situation, where participants stated they tried to be in it. The rest of the list included tactics like using active immersion, maintaining visual attention, staying engaged in what the actors said and did, and reminding yourself that it wasn't real. On the other hand, white knucklers took the same strategies and flipped them on their head. They tried to imagine it wasn't real, broke visual attention, resisted immersion, directed their mind to something else, and focused on getting to the finish. These are coping strategies designed to help us turn up or down the dial on sensations, feedback, and even our inner dialogue so that we can navigate our inner and outer worlds. They allow us to deal with, accept, or ignore the experience so that we can survive, thrive, or simply get through the discomfort. Broadly, we call these emotional regulation strategies, but I think that definition is too narrow. As we've learned throughout this book, the various sensations, emotions, and thoughts work in concert with one another. To regulate emotions means to influence the rest. We can be like the thrill seekers and fully immerse in the experience, reframing the potential fear as excitement, or we can be like the white knucklers, ignoring and suppressing our inner and outer worlds so that we make it through the experience. What coping strategy we use is up to us. But choosing the right one can keep us from reaching our breaking point, from spiraling out of control, from sprinting through the woods at the sound of a chainsaw with no chain. Attending to discomfort. When he lined up for the 1972 Olympic marathon, Frank Shorter was chasing history in a race that few understood and most saw as an event reserved for those with a screw loose. Shorter was in search of Olympic glory, attempting to win a race that hadn't seen a champion from the United States since 1908. Marathon running wasn't the mass participation event that it is now. It was in its infancy. The first New York City Marathon took place in 1970 and consisted of 127 scantily clad runners traversing Central Park. Even the historic Boston Marathon, which had begun in 1897, sported only 1,219 finishers in its 1972 edition. Quite a bit smaller than the nearly 40,000 runners that make their way to Boylston Street today. 2 hours and 12 minutes after the gun fired, Shorter would capture the elusive title, winning the Olympic gold at the Munich Games. Shorter's victory was the spark that set off the running boom. Within a few years, running would transform from something that a select breed of athletes would do to a mass participation event. Marathons and other road races sprang up in every city, and major races exploded into a festival-like atmosphere with tens of thousands of participants. Shorter's success and the explosion of running brought a search for understanding a sport that, until that point, had mostly been left on the fringes. Following the 1972 Olympics, a dream team of scientists assembled to unravel the mystery of the world's best runners. The list of scientists is a who's who of the pioneers in the field of exercise science: David Costill, Peter Cavanaugh, Kenneth Cooper, and others. The scientists knew they'd struggle to enlist the best athletes in the world to be poked and prodded, so they brought in Sports Illustrated writer Kenny Moore to help with recruitment. Moore just so happens to be the fourth place finisher in the 1972 Olympic Marathon. Moore helped recruit the best runners in America to participate in a barrage of physiological, biomechanical, and psychological tests. Frank Shorter was there, as was the legendary Steve Prefontaine, and a slew of other Olympians. The work that came out of this meeting of the minds would define our understanding of sports science for a generation. Two researchers, William Morgan and Michael Pollack, were tasked with picking apart the runner's psychology. While the masses were beginning to take to the streets, the cliché of the lonely long-distance runner held firm. Runners were introverted athletes who didn't mind spending hours tolerating ever-increasing amounts of discomfort. Morgan and Pollack wondered what set apart athletes like Shorter, who could master the psychological demands of the marathon. They threw an alphabet soup of questionnaires at the elite runners: the State Trait Anxiety Inventory, Somatic Perception Questionnaire, Depression Adjective Checklist, Profile of Mood States, Isenck Personality Inventory, and a slew of others. They had a chance to probe the minds of the world's best, and they took it. They were looking for anything that set apart this collection of elite marathoners from everyone else. After all of the questionnaires, they finished with an hour-long interview designed to unravel the runner's motivation and experience during races. The last question they asked was, "Describe what you think about during a long-distance run or marathon. What sort of thought processes take place as a run progresses?" The researchers, eminent in their field, hypothesized that these world-class runners must use dissociation of sensory input. In other words, tune out, distract themselves, turn their attention to anything but the painful, tedious act of running for over 2 hours. Contrary to their hypothesis, the elite runners didn't zone out. They did the opposite. They homed in, using an associative strategy. They concluded that the runners paid very close attention to bodily input such as feelings and sensations arising in their feet, calves, and thighs, as well as their respiration. Pace was largely governed by reading their bodies. On the other hand, the recreational runners in the study chose to dissociate, seldom paying attention to the actual act of running. Some would recall childhood memories. Others would write letters to friends, count, focus on the passing scenery, or sing songs in their head. The classic view of association versus dissociation dominated psychology and performance literature for the next several decades. It didn't apply to just runners or even athletes. attentional focus theories were applied to everything from optimizing learning to developing self-esteem, even to performance in bed. Experts were tuning in, and the rest of us were tuning out. Zooming in versus out. Have you ever been so locked in, so focused on the task at hand, that you haven't noticed your spouse calling your name, or maybe even the phone buzzing and beeping in the background? Often, we try to create such a state of blissful unawareness to the world around us when we're working on our craft or deep in the throes of writing. We intentionally fixate on what we're doing, neglecting everything else. Other times, such a state is thrust upon us. When pressure or stress is high, our world narrows in on what's right in front of us. When airplane pilots perform a nerve-wracking landing amid heavy crosswinds, they shift from the broad focus of being aware of the array of dials and instruments scattered around the cockpit to zooming in, seeing only what's right in front of them. In one study, 40% of pilots missed a loud beeping alarm during a wind shear landing. When our attention narrows, our cognition follows. Our eyes stop dancing from side to side and become stuck, staring at a few small points in front of us. All that matters is the narrow band of the world. Everything else is shut out. Pilots call this inattentional deafness. Scientists call it cognitive narrowing. There are advantages to such a response. When we narrow, we're redirecting all of our computing power to the handful of processes that matter. It's as if to help with our sluggish Wi-Fi, we disconnect our phone and tablet, just so that our video conference call won't lag. Narrowing also helps with goal attainment. It cuts out all of the other distractions and places the most important goal front and center. When we home in, we increase motivational intensity, reinforcing that what's in front of us is what we should be after. For a brief moment, the trade-off can be worthwhile. But when we remain zoomed in for too long, we start to miss cues and signals. We get locked in on one path without being able to step back and see a better route. When we're stuck narrowed in for too long, accidents go up and performance drops. We miss hearing alarms that signal there's a problem elsewhere. If marathoners are zooming in and pilots need to do the opposite to avert disaster, what do we do if we are on the brink of an argument with our spouse or a breakdown from the demands of our job? Do we copy the pilots or the runners, or take a different tack altogether? How do you know when to zoom in and when to zoom out in a challenging situation that risks spiraling out of control? New research helps provide an answer. How do pilots snap out of inattentional deafness, come back to normal, and pay attention to the dozens of sounds, sights, and signals bombarding their sensory centers? Do the opposite. Zoom out. When researchers out of the University of Michigan strategically reminded participants to broaden their attention throughout a stressful landing, their performance improved markedly. When we broaden our cognitive scope, it's as if we take the blinders off, open up the world to include our periphery. Going broad prevents us from getting too locked in on a particular decision or action. It also changes how our mind works. Imagine you are looking at a picture of a Rottweiler stretched out on a couch, eating a donut, and you've got 1 minute to come up with a title for the photo. What's the most unusual bird you can name off the top of your head? Think of as many functions of a brick as you can. These bizarre questions are examples of how scientists test for creativity. The more unusual the answers, the better. If you could only think about using a brick as a building block for a wall, your creative juices are pretty low. How about using a brick to break into your locked car? A tad better. If you answered that you'd grind up the brick into minuscule pieces and then create a brand new style of makeup out of it, your decision-making might be questioned, but your creativity wouldn't. Creativity is key to zooming out because it is the cornerstone of problem-solving, which is essential to our rethinking of toughness. Creativity broadens our world, opening up potential paths and preventing us from defaulting to the well-worn route that may be easy to follow, but ultimately leads us to more frustration. Whether you are facing your 20th rejection letter for that book that deserves publication, or trying to keep your sanity while wrangling 25-year-olds in a classroom, a little imagination can be the difference between giving up and finding a way forward. When researchers asked similar questions to a group of University of Maryland students, they weren't concerned with classifying who was creative and who was dull. They wanted to see if they could prime people's creativity. To get participants' imagination flowing, they handed them a map of Arkansas, not exactly a beacon of inspiration. They instructed half of the participants to look over the entire state. For the other half, they highlighted a bright red star in the center of the map, representing the city of Little Rock. This simple task forced people to zoom, narrow their focus on the city, or broaden their focus to see the entire state. Focus on the tree or see the forest. Afterward, they were handed a piece of paper with one of the aforementioned creativity puzzles to solve. The students primed with a broad attention task produced more unique answers. Those who focused on the city of Little Rock weren't as fortunate. Their minds were closer to bricks as building blocks instead of makeup. Variations of this experiment have been conducted using a variety of similar tactics, such as focusing on a leaf of a plant, that is, narrow focus, versus looking at the plant as a whole. Regardless of the setup, the results consistently show that when we go broad with our attention, our imagination runs wild and our creative juices flow. A narrow focus doesn't just leave our imagination empty. It plays a large role in rumination and depression. Think back to Chapter 7, where we discussed how our inner dialogue could spiral out of control toward a freakout moment. Our thoughts shift toward the negative, and all of the feedback we receive seems to validate our experience. Before we know it, we've quit whatever task we were performing, whether it is working on the same paper for 9 hours without taking a break, or trying to assemble your kid's playhouse for 3 hours using the bizarre disposable tools that came with it. That narrow focus blinded you to even considering other options or tools, and it made you either furious or drained, or both. One group of psychologists believe that rumination occurs when we have a narrow and inflexible focus of attention. We become so focused on a singular aspect, for example, a comment our boss or coworker made, that we can't break away from that thought or sensation. In the case of rumination, our narrow focus primes us to amplify the negative thoughts and doubts circling in our mind. Soon enough, we're incapable of seeing or listening to anything but that singular voice. Susie's snide remark about our presentation is stuck on replay in our mind. We can't pick up or listen to any sensory information that may let us know that our doubts are unfounded. Our worldview shrinks to what's right in front of us, screaming the loudest. Or put another way, if we are asked what a brick could be used for, our minds can't reach beyond its function in building a wall. Psychologist Barbara Fredrickson proposed a similar framework that works for emotions. The broaden and build theory of emotions states that positive emotions expand our cognition and our opportunities for action. According to Fredrickson, when we experience positive emotions, we're more likely to have novel thoughts, take on new challenges, and embrace new experiences. On the other hand, negative emotions tend to make us narrow our possibilities. Negative emotions constrain our thoughts and behavior. Our options become limited when we're swamped by anger. Whether it's attention, cognition, or emotion, the pattern is clear. Broad is the way to go. Narrow is to be avoided. How do we make sense of this broad versus narrow information in the context of the research on Frank Shorter and his world-class pals who tended to use associative strategies which are narrow by nature, focusing on how our arm is swinging, or the depth of our breathing, or the sensation of fatigue in our thighs? And isn't dissociation the preferred choice of slower runners, similar to a broad focus? If zooming in is tied to ruminative thoughts and a declining mood, then how do we make sense of the fact that some of the top marathoners in history zoomed in? If it seems like contrasting information, it's because it is. adjusting your state of mind. Every second, we are bombarded with information from within our body and from the outside world. Do we wait to react to it, or act before we're fully aware of what's going on? When it comes to making sense of the world and the information assailing us every second, our brain relies on two types of processing, top-down and bottom-up. The former relies on the brain acting in a predictive manner, utilizing experience and expectations to predict what will occur. Top-down processing is context-driven. It's present when you feel a wave of panic and anxiety take over when you are sitting quietly, waiting to be called up to the podium to give your speech. You haven't seen the audience or even the stage, yet based on context and prior experience, your brain is preparing for what's likely coming. On the other hand, bottom-up processing is sensory information-driven. You pick up a cue that triggers a reaction. Your brain is working in real time, reading the information, and then mounting a response. These processes aren't mutually exclusive. It's not as if our brain uses all top-down or all bottom-up processing. In most situations, we're using a combination of both. A dash of prediction, a touch of feedback, making our best guess using context, and taking in sensory information to either direct or course-correct our prediction. In 2020, neuroscientists Noah Hertz, Moshe Bar, and Shira Baror proposed that at any given time, we fall somewhere on a continuum between the two extremes of all top-down and all bottom-up processing. Where we fall on that continuum impacts not only our perception, but also our attention, thoughts, mood, and behavior. All are connected to either more top-down or more bottom-up processing. Hertz and colleagues chose names for the top-down and bottom-up sides of the spectrum, narrow and broad. The type of processing is the glue that binds perception, attention, thought, action, and mood together. Move toward the broad side, and we shift toward relying on sensory information for perception, having global attention, broad thinking, exploratory behavior, and a positive mood. Move toward a narrow state of mind, and our focus shifts to the trees instead of the forest. Our thinking becomes constrained. We tend to fall back on familiar choices and actions, and our mood sours. We linger where we are instead of exploring. The beauty of the state of minds theory is that it provides a simple framework founded on deep science to explain why zooming works. It explains why priming our mind to go broad leads to more creativity. It's not just shifting our attention so that our vision picks up more information. It's that we're shifting how our brain functions, dragging it from the narrow top-down function to the broad bottom-up. And as we change the ratio of processing, our attention, thoughts, action, and mood get dragged along. Narrow our attention, and our thoughts and mood follow suit. Broaden our thinking by performing a task that requires thinking holistically, and the rest gets dragged with it. In other words, seeing the forest instead of just the trees might not just help as a metaphor for life, but it could also change your current mood. The theory also explains why the old model of toughness fails. It limits our path. In the old model, to move forward, we have to dig in, grit it out, play through the pain. And if that fails, we're limited to doubling down, going through the same experience, hoping that somehow that outcome is different. The new model works much in the same way as the state of minds theory. It's about shifting how our brain works, and in turn how we interact with the thoughts, emotions, and feelings that come with a challenge. Instead of doubling down, we open ourselves up to new paths, sometimes going broad, other times narrow. Experiencing rumination? You've got narrow thinking, narrow attention, and constrained behavioral response. Attention, thought, and action all line up to lock into a cycle that is difficult to get out of. Throughout this book, we've detailed experiences where we spiral. We ruminate on an issue, our world narrows, our mood shifts, and if Hertz and colleagues are right, we've shifted to where we are almost all the way to the extreme of top-down processing. stuck in a loop where the only thing we can predict is doom. How do we get out of this narrow spiral? No different than the pilots who needed to broaden their view to get out of inattentional deafness, or the science that tells us to zoom out and think in third person instead of first person to broaden our perspective and disconnect ourselves from the experience. If we find ourselves getting narrow, counteract by going broad. This theory helps explain the advice that mood follows action. When we're feeling sad and down, trying to alter our mood seldom works. But if instead of trying to force your mood to change, you change your behavior, getting out of bed and going for a walk, you often find yourself in a much better, happier place. Your behavior dragged your mood with it. Rich Roll, a well-known podcaster who struggled with drug and alcohol addiction in his 20s and 30s, explains to me how he utilizes this principle. If I'm down or in a rut, I force myself to move my body, even if only a little bit. This helps shift my perspective and reset my operating system. And more often than not, the sun starts shining again. It's not that having a broad or narrow state of mind is better or worse. A narrow mind can be beneficial, keeping us focused on what's right in front of us, throwing all of our resources behind predicting what's going to happen next and preparing for how to handle it. Zooming in allows us to see the finer-grained details, to keep our goal front of mind, and to resist the pull of outside forces trying to steer us away from our current trajectory. The moments when we need to be on the far end of narrow processing are generally very short. If we linger, we spiral. Zooming out allows us to take in more information, to see new patterns and connections between disparate ideas. We're able to explore, to quickly shift the direction we're headed. But if we get stuck in a broad state of mind, we are left reacting to the environment as it comes. We spend too much time exploring the world around us and not enough taking advantage of the information and action possibilities sitting before us. Top performers figure out when to go broad and when to narrow. And that's the secret Frank Shorter and his marathon pals had stumbled upon. Exercises: broad versus narrow. Changing your processing ratio. The first step in utilizing any of the strategies below is to decide whether you need to zoom in or zoom out. Remember, stress causes us to narrow because it's advantageous for a short period of time. Stress locks us in and shifts us to focus on one goal instead of exploring others. But you also miss vital information, and over time, your inner voice and negative mood soon spiral. Elite performers can zoom in for longer than novices. They get the benefits of locking in on a goal without the negative mood and rumination following too quickly. It's about being able to flexibly zoom in and out as needed. Remember that each strategy is designed to drag the other categories with them. If we shift our attention, we're pulling our thoughts, actions, and mood with us. 1. Visual zooming, portrait versus panorama mode. Direct your focus of attention, almost staring at an object, picking up as many details as possible in a small area. That's portrait mode. It primes your mind for a single task, shifting you to a narrow state of mind. On the other hand, softening your gaze to an almost blurry state where you attempt to pick up everything in the periphery is what I call panorama mode. You want to broaden your attention. When feeling overwhelmed by discomfort, taking a second to blur your vision helps shift you away from spiraling downward. 2. Cognitive zooming, weird versus normal. This is what I like to call the Family Feud style of thinking. In the TV game show, they present you with a challenge, for example, name something that goes up and down, and then you have to answer what you think people who were surveyed would have answered. Early on, you want to guess the most common answers, like maybe an elevator. But once you're down to your last answer on the board, you have to start guessing strange things that maybe one or two random people on the street might have come up with. That's narrow versus broad thinking. Common answers are narrow. Unusual answers are broad. The former primes us for focus and concentration, the latter for creativity and innovation. 3. physical zooming. Mood follows action. We have covered this idea so far in the book, but to reiterate, one study took participants and sat them in a chair. They told participants to either lean forward so that they were on the edge of their seat, anticipating what was coming, or lean back in a fully reclined, comfortable position. After getting into position, subjects were given a task to categorize a group of pictures. Those who reclined in the chair were more likely to choose broad categories, coming up with creative ways to make, say, a vehicle and a camel fit in the same category. When on the edge of their seat, they stuck to narrow categories. Not only does our mood follow action, but so do our thinking, perception, and so forth. Alter your actions to go broad or narrow. 4. Temporal zooming. Imagine the future. When you are going through a difficult time, ask how you might feel about this in 6 months, a year, or even 10 years down the line. Imagining how future you would think about your current situation often reminds us that whatever we are going through is temporary, and that in the future, it'll be an indistinguishable blip in our life story. 5. Linguistic zooming. Remember from Chapter 7 that when we switch from first person to either second or third person, we are putting distance between what's occurring and our response to it. This doesn't just apply to our inner dialogue, but journaling using second or third person can also help us process our emotions. 6. Environmental zooming. To get much work done, modern writers often have to find a quiet desk tucked away in an office with little to no distractions, and, of course, the Wi-Fi disabled. They want to narrow in on the task at hand, so they create an environment that allows them to do so. On the other hand, research shows that going for a walk out in nature, or even looking at pictures of awe-inspiring natural wonders, sparks creativity, shifts us so that we see difficult situations as a challenge instead of a threat, and allows us to bounce back and recover more quickly from stress. Nature expands our perspective. Set up your environment so it invites the action and mental state that allows you to perform. To suppress or address: how to navigate life and death. In the fall of 2010, Katie Arnold welcomed her second daughter into the world. 3 months later, she watched her father succumb to cancer. Reflecting on this challenging time, Arnold told me, "It was a perfect storm of grief and postpartum. I was in a kind of hormonal stew with everything turning topsy-turvy." For the Outside magazine editor, the whirlwind of life's giving and taking set off a cascade of emotions. Love, fear, rage, regret, disappointment, tenderness, shame, surprise, anguish, even awe. Grief is all of these things and more, a big messy wad of emotion. It is beyond category, as fathomless as desire, as luminous as joy. It will break your heart and fill it up again, Arnold wrote in her memoir, Running Home. The anxiety was immobilizing and crippling. To Arnold, grief wasn't just an emotion. There was a physicality to it. She explained, "I knew that grief was an emotional state, but I didn't know it was physical. My grief manifested as pain in my body, aches in my joints, this heavy weight on me. And I became afraid that was a signal that physically something was wrong with me. I had a conviction or certainty that I was dying too. Any ache jumped straight from slight discomfort to a full-blown fear that the pain in her elbow or stomach or knee must be cancer. This went on for a year and a half." There are few experiences as universal as dealing with the mess of emotions that comes with death and figuring a way through it. Unbeknownst to Arnold at the time, her experience of grief as something physical and her taking on the pain of the loved one she lost are relatively common when going through grief. Arnold was at a loss. "I could not talk my way out of it. People could not reassure me this was not true. I tried lots of different healing and therapies. Some worked a little, others did not. But really what worked for me was running. Moving on my own 2 feet through the wilderness," she relayed. Being alone in her head was the only time I could move beyond my fear thoughts. At the start of every run, my anxiety was super heightened. But as I ran, that rhythmic repetition lulled me into a moving meditation where the thoughts dropped away, and a realization that the body was strong. The body holds the wisdom. It was sending a message. Actually, you're healthy, Katie. Running became her salvation, her time to quiet her mind and the fear and rumination that came with it. There wasn't competitiveness to it, as she told me. It was a meditative, thought-free place where my imagination wasn't going haywire. The mind-clearing exercise eventually led the once recreational runner to the top of the ultra-endurance world, where she topped the women's field of the prestigious Leadville 100-miler in 2018. One of the hardest things that anyone can go through is losing a parent, spouse, or child. The grief can be overwhelming, pushing us toward depression and despair. When the death of a loved one occurs, we're left with a gaping hole in our lives and a mess of emotions that we can't quite make sense of. Some of us bottle up our feelings or distract ourselves by going all in on our job to numb the pain. Others choose to work through the grief, talking to a friend or therapist about what they are feeling. Managing grief often feels like our own internal ultramarathon. Beyond the question of zooming in or out as a coping strategy, how do we deal with and regulate our emotions, whether those are grief, sorrow, or even fear? Do we ignore them, move on, embrace them, or fall prey to them? There are several different ways to regulate our emotions. Broadly, we can categorize them based on whether they rely primarily on attention or cognition. Attention strategies direct our focus toward or away from the emotion. We can concentrate on an item, shining a spotlight that amplifies the sensations around it. Or we can distract ourselves, filling our working memory with something else to deal with, preventing that initial feeling of anger from having time to grow. We focus on our children or our work to keep our mind from drifting back to our loss. Distraction and concentration are low-cost strategies, requiring just a smidge of cognitive effort, a simple shifting of where we shine our spotlight. We're not trying to do anything with the actual experience. Cognitive strategies are more complex, utilizing cognitive control to suppress, detach, or reappraise the emotion. Instead of relying only on directing our focus, cognitive strategies involve actively engaging with the emotion. Suppression relies on dampening down the feeling or sensation, while reappraisal involves reframing the experience into something that you can handle. If psychologists could crack the code on what strategies allowed us to deal with sadness, for example, the benefits to humanity would be enormous. Like prescribing a rehab exercise to cure that old knee pain, we could prescribe different coping strategies to deal with the emotional turmoil in our lives. As research mounted in the late 20th century, scientists went as far as labeling strategies like concentration that led to rumination as maladaptive, while others like reappraisal were seen as adaptive. And the research backed it up. When subjects concentrated on their thoughts for too long, their emotions spiraled. As a strategy to handle sadness or grief, rumination failed repeatedly. Reappraisal had the opposite effect, helping shift individuals' experience from negative to positive. Turning anxiety into excitement or disappointment into an opportunity for growth seems to help people deal with failure or grief in a productive manner. Some strategies helped and others hindered. But like most aspects in life, as we dive deeper, the straightforward narrative disappears. Starting in 2010, it became apparent that the good and bad dichotomy fell apart on an individual level. It wasn't as simple as feeling anger, then trying to distract ourselves. Emotional regulation required more nuance. In a 2011 study titled Emotion Regulation Choice, a team of scientists led by Gal Sheps and James Gross at Stanford signaled a need for a course correction. They stated, "These studies have enormously advanced the field of emotion regulation. However, a new generation of studies has begun to cast doubt on the unconditional, maladaptive-adaptive label given to different strategies. After the alarm was set off, a series of studies validated what Gross and colleagues suggested. Good and bad was too simple. Everything worked and failed. Every strategy had benefits and came with a cost. Take, for example, the principal maladaptive strategy of rumination. It's easy to see why letting your thoughts spiral hinders emotional regulation. After all, rumination has a close relationship with anxiety and depression. But researchers have found that rumination helps when we have to maintain focus on a singular goal. If our mind and thoughts get stuck on a goal that matters and is beneficial, rumination keeps us from drifting away. So-called deliberate rumination causes us to make fewer errors when performing singularly focused tasks and actually facilitates post-traumatic growth after a harrowing experience. In tasks that require shifting between different goals, it largely fails. Another strategy that typically makes matters worse is suppression. What inevitably happens is when we actively resist, the object of our ire comes back with a vengeance. However, researchers found that suppression works well when the situation is particularly dire. For instance, suppressing negative emotions after a spouse passes away helps reduce grief over the long haul. Compartmentalizing is a form of suppression that many of us use in our everyday lives. We note a sensation of stress, but tuck it away in the corner of our mind until we have the resources to address it. That latter part is the key. Suppression is a short-term solution. Eventually, we have to deal with the experience. Even reappraisal, a strategy that a meta-analysis of nearly 200 studies showed was the most effective coping strategy, fails in some instances. When dealing with intense emotional situations, our capacity to focus on and then reinterpret what an emotion means falters. When compared to strategies like distraction, reappraisal requires more cognitive bandwidth. Instead of directing your attention elsewhere, it requires focusing on an item without being overpowered by the feeling or thought, and then devoting a large chunk of your mind's resources to altering your initial view, all while under a heavy load of stress or fatigue. Reappraising anxiety as excitement is easy when the feeling comes from getting up the nerve to sell Girl Scout cookies to strangers. It's much more difficult when that sales pitch is to a boardroom full of investors and your company's future is on the line. Even the best strategies fail when we don't have the capacity to use or handle them. If everything works and doesn't, how do we make sense of and apply all of this information when we are faced with something difficult? Research on bereavement provides an answer. In one study, psychologists set out to understand why some people could cope with losing a loved one reasonably well and why it sent others careening into a long period of despair. To understand what was going on, they took 40 individuals who had lost a spouse in the past 3 years and had them evaluated by a number of clinical psychologists. The subjects were then classified as either handling their loss with some success or going through complicated grief, an experience of prolonged loneliness, difficulty in accepting what had occurred, or a sense of the meaninglessness of life. Once classified, both groups were put through what's called an expressive flexibility task. Subjects are presented with a series of pictures designed to evoke a range of positive and negative emotions, as images of cute puppies, the World Trade Center tumbling down, or feces smeared all over a toilet popped onto their screens. Participants were asked to enhance, suppress, or do nothing with the emotion the picture evoked. The better they were able to turn up or down the volume on the emotion, the better their expressive flexibility. Not surprisingly, those who suffered from complicated grief scored lower in expressive flexibility. When it came to regulating or adjusting their emotions, they were stuck, incapable of adjusting the inner volume. The successful grievers, on the other hand, had control over the experience. They could amplify or suppress their emotions, no matter what was presented. Coping flexibility allows for adapting to adversity in a positive direction over the long haul. The best performers tend to have a flexible and adaptive coping ability. They can bounce between different strategies depending on the demands of the situation. Top marathoners possess this ability, as do the most resilient individuals who overcome grief and trauma. Flexible coping is tied to everything from dealing with trauma to college students adjusting to life on their own and homesickness. Sheps and Gross offered the following summary. Healthy adaptation is the result of flexibly choosing between regulation strategies to adapt to differing situational demands. It's not that distraction, suppression, reappraisal, detachment, or shifting to a broad or narrow worldview is good or bad. They all work and don't. Toughness maxim. The best performers tend to have a flexible and adaptive coping ability. They can bounce between different strategies depending on the demands of the situation. Flexible and adaptable. In 2017, I conducted an informal study comparing where the minds of a group of college and professional athletes went during discomfort. During a series of grueling workouts and competitions, the athletes completed a survey about where they directed their attention. Contrary to the earlier research, the best athletes weren't relying on association, and poorer performers weren't relying on dissociation. Everyone was using both strategies, just to different degrees and at different times. The best athletes reported tuning into their body at crucial moments, getting the lay of the land on how their body felt. At other times, they reported trying to zone out. They even had a name for the strategy after it was utilized with great success: turning your brain off. One athlete described the experience like this: I tried to turn my brain off, lock on to the competitor ahead of me, get in autopilot for a bit, just letting my body do what it knows how to do, until the race got more difficult and I'd need to zone back in. It was like I was storing up my energy until I really needed to dig deep. They weren't just using one strategy. They were changing their focus at different times in response to the demands of the event. Fatigue and a rising uncertainty about whether they could finish? Flip the switch and home in. Are those around them starting to make tactical moves? Shift attention to their surroundings and competitors. As I quizzed the athletes, the best performers were directing attention to help cope with the demands of the race, and the strategies were vast and complex. It wasn't as simple as associate or dissociate, and recent research backs up my observations. Since Pollock and Morgan's seminal study in 1975, a clearer picture has emerged. At the 1988 Olympic trials, John Silva and Mark Applebaum interviewed 32 of the United States' top marathoners and found that while association was the dominant strategy used, dissociation was used as well. The top marathoners reported being in flux, changing between strategies. Silva and Applebaum concluded that elite marathoners employed what they called an adaptive, flexible strategy. Now we can fully understand Frank Shorter and his pals' approach to mastering the discomfort of the marathon. Elite runners obtain this flexibility by developing their capacity to utilize strategies while under stress and fatigue. The reason novice marathoners default to dissociation is that they quickly become overwhelmed when the intensity of the experience gets too high. They don't have the capacity to use strategies that take a large amount of cognitive effort or that might amplify the experience in the short term. Their resources are directed at surviving. When emotional intensity gets too high, we default toward the easiest path, distraction. It's a low-cost solution that allows us to manage something in the short term. On the other hand, during periods of pain, fatigue, and suffering, that is, high emotional intensity, elite runners can still use strategies that require directing attention toward the experience. They can focus inward on a feeling, thought, or sensation without it overwhelming them. The ability to home in when their mind is screaming at them to turn their attention elsewhere allows them to extract more information and potentially reappraise what they are experiencing. Without the ability to focus, reappraisal can't occur. Elite runners don't just choose to associate more than novices. They have the capabilities to do so. Through years of training, they've learned to use regulation strategies that take more resources and effort, even during the most demanding moments. This particular skill isn't reserved for the fastest runners among us. It's a pattern that we all experience. As any parent can attest, toddlers and young children are prone to emotional outbursts filled with crying, tantrums, and fits. They're masters at generating strong emotions, but novices at regulating. Their skill set is heavily tilted toward emotional generation, and it shows. Part of development and getting through the terrible twos and into the school-age years is tilting that seesaw back in favor of emotion regulation. In tracking how children develop the capacity to regulate emotions, early-stage strategies surface first. Infants as young as 6 months old start to show signs of attention regulation. They divert their eyes from objects that cause them distress. By the time they turn two, distraction seems to be the coping strategy of choice. Two-year-olds are capable of turning their attention to another object or person to deal with emotional discomfort. Reappraisal and other cognitive strategies aren't developed until much later. In two different studies, researchers measured the brain's electrical activity to see whether children could successfully reappraise an emotional stimulus. When we are able to reappraise a negative emotion and turn it into a positive one, there's a reduction in the late positive potential, LPP, a neural signal that reflects how much attention we're giving an emotion. When researchers studied 5 to 7-year-old children, there was no change in electrical signal, indicating that children hadn't been able to reappraise fear and anxiety. However, in a study on 8 to 12-year-olds, researchers found a change in LPP, indicating a successful reappraisal. Whether children learn to reappraise at 6 or 8 isn't the point. It's that cognitive strategies like reappraisal take time to develop. They are skills. In many ways, our novice marathoners are like the young children capable of distraction, while our elite runners have the full capacity to use more cognitively demanding and complex strategies. At one time, we were all the child who moved from annoyance to despair as we struggled to regulate our inner turmoil. Our journey toward real toughness is much the same. We start with only one solution: grind it out. Ignore much of what's going on inside. It may help us get through minor difficulties, but eventually it fails. We have to adopt a way to navigate the complex feelings, emotions, and thoughts that swirl whenever we are faced with a challenge. Over time, we gain the ability to pay attention to our inner world, navigate the experience without freaking out, and ultimately make better decisions. As adults, we all have the machinery and capacity to develop that ability. The capacity to cope. Imagine for a second you're standing with a few friends at the top of a snow-covered hill. One of your friends decides it would be a good idea to make a nice round snowball and send it careening down the hill. After a gentle nudge, the snowball starts to pick up steam and size. As it makes its way down the slope, the bigger and bigger it grows, and faster it goes. You glance down to the bottom of the hill, and a family is sitting there quietly, unaware of the now giant snowball barreling toward them. What have you done? By the time you notice the family, the snowball has gained so much momentum that it's nearly impossible to stop it. You can't get in its way, and you can't divert it. Welcome to a full-blown freakout. We can think of the process of toughness as the snowball on the hill. Our emotions, thoughts, and feelings work in the same way, gaining momentum as we make our way from initial sensation to taking action. If you've ever found yourself ruminating on an argument, replaying it over and over, you are familiar with the momentum-gaining power of feelings, emotions, and thoughts. According to the process model of emotions, emotions gain steam as they go through cycles of attention, appraisal, and response. We start with a small, simple feeling, but as it stirs around in our mind, as we divert more and more of our attentional resources, as we try to react to the discomfort, it grows in power. We've pushed the snowball down a hill, This cycle repeats until the emotion has been extinguished, been redirected, or taken over. Whenever we face a situation that requires toughness, we are attempting to stop the snowball careening down the mountain. If our only hope to stop the snowball is to stand in its way, put our hands up, and yell, "Come at me!" chances are slim that everything will turn out all right. That's old toughness, a simplistic solution to a difficult situation. Real toughness is about having a myriad of potential options. Many will fail, but the chances are a lot higher that we'll find a way to stop or minimize the damage of a careening snowball. We can intervene early, putting a stop to the ball before it even starts to roll. Or we may be able to slow the momentum of it, making sure that it's only nudged instead of shoved. That's akin to using distraction, a low-cost strategy that works well early before it's gained too much momentum. But what if you can't catch the snowball before it has picked up speed? That's where cognitive strategies like reappraisal come in. Instead of trying to stop the snowball in its tracks, you are trying to push it onto a new path. Being tough is standing on that hill, recognizing the danger, and figuring out how to keep that snowball from gaining speed and crashing down into the family standing at the bottom of the hill. If we can take away its power by slowing its momentum, and if we have the ability and flexibility to use one of several options at any point along the journey, then our chances of successfully intervening are higher. When it comes to developing toughness, the role of coping strategies is clear. Our ability to be tough is dependent on the emotions and thoughts that push or pull us toward a decision or behavior. Coping strategies act to amplify or blunt the effects of those thoughts, feelings, and emotions. We can use simple techniques, like directing our attention, or complex ones that involve cognition, like reappraisal. Where we direct our focus and cognition can push us toward a freakout or enable us to work through whatever it is we are facing. The old model of toughness, ignore and suppress, pushed us toward a limited selection of strategies. We were taught that experiencing doubts and fears was a sign of weakness, that we shouldn't listen to the sensations of pain or fatigue that were screaming at us. In the old model, the preferred way through this jumbled mess of thoughts, emotions, and feelings was to bulldoze our way to the finish line. That approach ultimately backfires. Thankfully, modern research and practice teach us another lesson. Develop an arsenal of strategies so that when adversity arises, you'll have the right tool for the job. Be adaptable instead of rigid and stoic. When it comes to using coping strategies, the science points to two key attributes that we need to develop: flexibility to use different strategies, capacity to be able to utilize them. When it comes to making tough decisions, we need to practice different strategies, zooming in and out, distracting and associating, and so forth. The labels and categories don't matter as much as the ability to use them. It's only through applying the different strategies in a variety of situations that we learn what works. And sometimes, your tried and true way of dealing with a thought or emotion simply won't work. As world-class runner Brian Barraza told me, "You cycle through different strategies, seeing what works and discarding what doesn't. Over time, you pick up that certain strategies work better in certain races or situations. But if you build your arsenal, what you've got is 2 to 3 different strategies for each point in a race. Practice and experience teach you what works when." The other state of top performance. "That didn't even feel hard," the athlete exclaimed after achieving a personal best. Diving further into their experience, they rattled off how seemingly magical the performance was. "I was in the zone. Everything was clicking. It was like I was just watching myself perform. I wasn't even thinking about the race. I just got into a rhythm and let my body go to work. I was on autopilot." When we perform on the field, on stage, or in the boardroom, we often expect it to be difficult. A race should hurt. A speech should be nerve-wracking. But every once in a while, we have a surreal experience where it all comes together, and the difficult becomes routine. Renowned psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi gave this rare but welcomed experience a name, flow. According to Csikszentmihalyi, flow is a state where the ego falls away. Time flies. Every action, movement, and thought follows inevitably from the previous one, like playing jazz. Your whole being is involved, and you're using your skills to the utmost. While the somewhat mysterious concept of flow is difficult to describe, for anyone who has experienced it, they know exactly what it feels like. Once experienced, the state of flow becomes like a drug, something that performers seek out. Papers and books have been written about rigging your environment and mindset to increase your chances of entering this vaunted state. Author Stephen Kotler founded the Flow Genome Project to discover how to unlock the secrets of flow and help us all perform better by entering the state more often. For the past few decades, sports psychology has focused on how to help performers enter a flow state. That was the key to performance. Get there more often, and great performances would follow. After an incredible performance, individuals occasionally report the exact opposite experience to the ease and magic of flow. That was the hardest thing I've done in my life. It was a grind the whole time. Somehow I got it done. A competition where every step required immense effort, where doubt, pain, and fatigue were at their highest, and nothing seemed to come easy. Yet, they found a way through the difficulty and came away rewarded with a win or personal best. When it comes to performing at our peak capacity, we often think there's only one path. Traditionally, that route has been through flow. But what the experience of the best performers and the latest psychology shows is that there's more than one road to the top. When Christian Swan and colleagues interviewed athletes from different sports on their experience after a big win or personal best, they identified two distinct states that led to top performances. The first they described as letting it happen, an experience that corresponded to the concept of flow. It was easy and enjoyable. The other state was much more difficult, described as gritty and grinding. This performance state occurred during an important part of the game, when pressure was high and an outcome was on the line. The athletes were able to raise their performance not by going into autopilot, but by narrowing their focus, deliberately increasing their effort, and making it happen. The athletes were experiencing a clutch state. Two different psychological states. One easy, one very difficult. One that came to them, one they seemingly had to force. Both bringing about peak performance. When scientists set out to unravel these two states that led to equally impressive performances, a few differences emerged. While both states shared a feeling of enhanced motivation, perceived control, absorption, and confidence, they diverged when it came to three key components: attention, arousal, and effort. Flow states contained effortless attention, optimal arousal, and an automatic, effortless experience, while clutch states contained complete and deliberate focus, heightened awareness and arousal, and an intense effort. While Csikszentmihalyi emphasized the role of complete focus in his original definition of flow, it's not the deliberate focus that we think about. One basketball player described the experience as just really focused without being focused. You're tuned in without having to focus, without having to tell yourself to focus. In one review, researchers went so far as stating, "Prolonged effortless concentration of attention is the principal characteristic of the flow experience." Attention isn't just a descriptor, but it's also a way to facilitate or maintain the experience. In another study, Swan and colleagues found that top athletes reported using distractions, such as daydreaming or letting their mind wander off to the scenery around them, as a tactic to stay in a flow state. Similarly, golfers who reported being in the zone deliberately directed their focus away from the game, talking to their caddy so that they didn't get in their own way. On the other hand, to experience a clutch state, athletes report narrowing their focus instead of zooming out or utilizing distraction. They shift their goals from being open-ended, for example, I want to win, to being fixed and specific, I need to score 5 points in the next minute. They heighten their focus to amplify their arousal, homing in on the feeling of nervousness to keep them from being complacent, or attending to the pain so that they can make a quick assessment of what they have left in the tank and how to use it. Narrow, zoomed in, focused. A deliberate use of attention to get them through tough times. But that wasn't all. Athletes experiencing clutch states report one more difference. They had to actively make a decision. There was a definite feeling of a switching of gears and, right, okay, things are quite serious here. A feeling of having to take action, a polar explorer reported to Swan and colleagues when they were investigating clutch states. Clutch states didn't just appear. Athletes didn't just happen upon them. With clutch states, there was a conscious decision to increase effort and intensity. They had to flip the switch. How they did so varied, but when they were at the toughest part of the performance, they figured out how to choose to increase their effort. Clutch required choosing. Flow required experiencing. Two different states, both bringing about top performance. One requires grit, the other grace. One accepting, the other a conscious decision. In many ways, the clutch versus flow paradigm reflects toughness. We tend to think of it as a singular method. Push through, persist. But as we've come to realize, that's a false constriction. Being tough means being able to choose the right strategy, given your abilities and the situation. How do we square the push for equanimity and the flexibility to suppress, ignore, accept, or redirect as needed? In discussing growing from adversity in his book Transcend, The New Science of Self-Actualization, psychologist Scott Barry Kaufman stated that the key is to have equanimity as your default, but to retain the capacity for defense, fighting, and taking a forceful stand. Equanimity is about creating the space to be able to respond. And sometimes, that means choosing to flip the switch. The fourth pillar of toughness. Transcend discomfort.